Some cases close with a confession, some close with a conviction, and some never really close at all. The Grimes Tapes is a detective fiction series following Detective Sarah Grimes as she works the cases that don't fit neatly into a file. Cases where power, politics, and human nature collide. And the truth is, the last thing anyone wants found. Episode 5, Ellis. A name surfaces. A county file is unsealed. The DNA tells a story about a family that rewrote its own history, and Grimes begins to understand what Tom Brannick found and what it cost him. The Whitfield County file arrived unsealed on a Thursday morning, and Grimes spread it across her desk the way you'd spread something you suspected was still warm. Callahan had brought the lab report to her desk the night before. 12 words. The autosomal profile does not match the reference sample for Nathan Brannick. He'd set it down and said, "You were right," and she'd read it twice and not answered him, because being right here didn't feel like the thing that word usually meant. There was a man in a cell who didn't know yet. There was a victim who'd been beaten to death in a hotel bathtub and not yet fully understood. And there was whoever had actually done it, who had spent 3 weeks watching the wrong person absorb the blame. She'd gone home, slept 4 hours, come back to the unsealed file. The documentation was thin, child welfare bureaucracy at its most skeletal. An infant removal, an emergency placement, the assigned caseworker, Claire Harmon. The mother, Lily Whitmore, 14 years old at the time of delivery, deceased. Cause, complications of childbirth. Father, unknown on the birth certificate. Interim custody, maternal grandmother, Edna Whitmore, and her second husband. Sibling noted in the household, Ellis Whitmore, brother, 21 at the time. The name from Tom's legal pad. The name that had been sitting underlined on her board for a week and a half with no context, just wait. Grimes ran Ellis Whitmore through the databases while the precinct came to life around her. The overnight guys handing off to the day shift, coffee going cold in paper cups, the particular ambient noise of a building that never fully stopped. She ran his name through the state system, the federal system, financial records, property records. She ran Edna Whitmore and got a death certificate, 7 years ago, cardiac event. She ran the step-grandfather and got another one, older, 11 years back. No surviving family in the Whitmore household except Ellis. Ellis Whitmore, 44, financial consultant, his own firm, suburban address, home purchased in his name alone, no co-borrower, no liens. No criminal record, no civil suits, no noise. He had rebuilt himself into the kind of man who didn't exist in databases except in the cleanest possible ways. Property taxes paid, professional licenses current, a website for his firm with a professional headshot and a list of credentials. Grimes looked at the headshot for a long time. Same build, same jaw as the booking photo in her folder. Not identical, Nate was younger, the angles different, but the resemblance had a logic to it that made her stomach tighten. Biology expressing itself. Callahan came in around 8 with 2 coffees and set one on the corner of her desk. He looked at the board. She'd added Ellis's headshot overnight. He looked at it the way you look at something you need to account for. "Here's the shape of it," she said, not presenting, thinking out loud. She walked through it with him, the two of them in front of the board rather than the whole room. Lily Whitmore gets pregnant at 14. The father isn't documented. The brother, Ellis, is 21 and in the household. The girl had a reputation, so the pregnancy gets explained away, and the brother goes unexamined. Lily dies in childbirth. Baby goes to the grandmother and the step-grandfather, who isn't kind and isn't interested. Ellis is in the clear. The only person who knew is dead. "Then Claire takes the baby," Callahan said. "She sees the home. She has suspicions about the pregnancy. She makes a decision." And 23 years pass. And Claire dies, and Tom finds out what she did, and Tom starts searching. She pointed to the legal pad photograph pinned to the board. Tom's handwriting, the name Ellis underlined twice. Tom's outreach reaches Ellis. Could be directly, could be through someone connected to the family. And Ellis understands exactly what Tom coming around means. A reunion, DNA tests, medical histories, questions about who the biological father is. She turned from the board. Questions that answer themselves if you run the right tests. Callahan was quiet for a moment. He was sitting, which he'd been doing more since the lab report arrived, as if standing required a certainty he was still getting back. So he killed the one person who didn't know it couldn't be made right. It was the right way to put it. She didn't say that.
"We need Devin Carter," she said.
They brought the bellhop back in that afternoon. Devin Carter, 22, night shift, who'd said could beat a Nate's booking photo 3 weeks ago in a room that smelled like institutional cleaner and stale coffee. Grimes handled the photo array herself. 6 photos, printed at the same size, arranged on the table, the standard procedure, the kind that defense attorneys couldn't pick apart. Ellis's corporate headshot was in the third position. She set the array in front of Devin and waited. He looked at them for a long time. She'd learned not to rush this. People rushed witnesses into certainty they didn't actually have, and certainty without foundation was worse than no identification at all. It was a wall you'd have to knock down later. Devin's finger came to rest on the third photo. "This one." He didn't say it like a question, but he wasn't done. "This is closer. The build, the way he was moving, not like he was lost, like he knew where he was going and didn't want anyone to track him. This one." "Not the first photo we showed you. The first one looked like this one, but this one's closer." He looked up. "I can't swear to it. I didn't get a long look." "I understand." Grimes pulled the array back. "You're saying the photo in the third position more closely resembles the man you saw in the lobby that night than the previous photograph you were shown?" "Yes, that's, yeah." Not a slam dunk identification, but corrections had their own momentum, and this one pointed where she'd been pointing for 24 hours. She pulled chain of custody records that evening and found what she'd been quietly afraid she'd find. A bathroom mirror shard, logged at the crime scene, photographed in situ, given an evidence number, entered into the transport manifest, and then nothing. No receipt at the lab, no follow-up notation. The kind of absence that only becomes visible when you know to look for it, when the case has shifted and you start checking the architecture for load-bearing pieces that have gone missing. She requested the transport records. She requested Terrence Boyle's personnel file. Boyle was a 6-year crime scene tech with a clean record and no flags. Good work, commendations for thoroughness, the kind of file that read fine until you looked at it in relation to a specific $5,000 cash deposit that appeared in his checking account several weeks back. She requested his financial records through the department liaison, which took until the following morning. By then, she knew what she was going to find. She drove to his house on a Saturday. He answered the door in sweatpants and looked at her badge with the expression of a man who had been expecting this visit and had not decided what to do about it. "Detective Grimes," she said, "I'm looking into the evidence chain for the Brannick case." "I want a lawyer." "That's your right." She left, drove back to the precinct. Saturday night, he called the main line. She was in the building. She let it go. She came back Monday morning with a printout of the deposit and set it on his kitchen table without sitting down. $5,000, cash, 12 days after the murder. She didn't say anything. She waited. Boyle sat across the table and looked at the printout for a long time. He'd been watching the case shift. The second DNA result was the kind of thing that moved through the law enforcement community before it moved through channels. He'd known this was coming. What he was working out was whether it was better to lawyer up and wait, or to get ahead of it while getting ahead was still an option. The conscience is easier when the self-preservation calculation points the same direction. "He didn't come directly," Boyle said. "The person who approached me. He came through someone I knew, someone in the system, a contact. It was casual the first time, nothing said directly, just a question about how careful the evidence handling had been on a particular case." He looked up at Grimes. A week later, the contact asked again, more specifically, and there was a number attached to the ask. $5,000. Yes, and the shard. I told myself it probably didn't matter. They already had the guy. The DNA was already in. Where is it? In my garage, coffee can on the shelf above the dryer. Grimes sent Callahan to collect it. She sat in Boyle's kitchen while she waited and didn't speak. Boyle made coffee she didn't ask for and served it in a mug with a faded logo on the side, and they sat with the sound of the refrigerator and the particular quiet of a conversation that had finished but couldn't fully end until the physical object had been transferred. The shard had dried blood on its edge. Ellis Whitmore's blood, as near as she could tell from the original photos, deposited when his fist went through the glass that was the last thing standing between Tom Brannick and what was coming for him. She drove back to the precinct and put it in evidence and stood at the board for a moment. She'd been right. She'd been right about all of it. That was supposed to feel like something, and it didn't feel like what it was supposed to feel like. It felt like standing at the edge of what had happened and counting the cost. Melina called on Tuesday. Callahan took it in the hallway, and Grimes could hear his voice through the glass, low, patient, steady. The patience of a man doing work he knew mattered and hated having to do. "Hank, the autosomal analysis excludes Nate. The YSTR matched because they share a paternal line. They're biologically related. But the contributor is a different person. And the secondary analysis found elevated homozygosity in Nate's own profile. His biological parents were closely related. First-degree relatives." She couldn't hear Melina. She could read Callahan's posture. "That means the killer isn't Nate. It's someone in the biological family he didn't know he had. And Tom had been trying to find that family." The call went on for 20 minutes. At the end, Melina hung up. Callahan stood in the hallway for a moment with his hand still holding the phone, then walked back in. Garza called an hour later. Quieter. Not convinced, but not hostile. Garza was a man who ran on his gut, and his gut had been telling him something was wrong since he'd walked into the jail and looked at Nate through the glass. "What do you need from us?" he asked. Wheeler called after that. He asked if Nate was okay. Callahan handled all three calls. He didn't ask Grimes to take them, and she didn't offer. He was doing the hardest work of his time on the job, standing in the fault line between the Brotherhood and the truth, the cop's kid telling his father's people they'd been wrong. It wasn't graceful, and it wasn't quick. It was just work, the way the whole case had been work, one conversation at a time. Janet Okoye came to the jail on a Tuesday afternoon, which was not her usual day. Nate had spent the week trying to unhear the word Garza had dropped and walk out of his cell carrying it. Adoption. Garza hadn't finished the sentence. He'd left it sitting there, and Nate had been living in the gap it opened. He'd been good at not thinking about it, in the way you get good at things you practice out of necessity. Then Janet came through the door with her briefcase and her file, and the expression she kept controlled, and he thought, today is something. She sat down across the table from him. She opened the file and set it in front of her and didn't consult it. The DNA results came back from the secondary analysis, she said. Nate waited. The autosomal profile doesn't match you. The blood under your father's fingernails, the blood the prosecution has been citing, it isn't yours. He sat with that. The room didn't change. The same walls, the same fluorescent hum, the air that never quite felt like outside air.
But something in the room did something, or something in him did something, because the sentence he'd been carrying for weeks, the DNA matched, therefore, had just had its foundation removed, and he couldn't figure out where to put his weight. That's good, he said. It sounded strange coming out, not because it was wrong, but because it was so inadequate. It means they're looking at someone else, a relative, someone in your biological family. There it was again, that phrase. You keep saying that, Nate said. Everyone keeps saying that. Biological family. Garza said, he stopped. What does that mean?
Janet's hands were still on the table. She was telling him things in order. He could feel it, the careful sequencing of it, the way she'd chosen biological family twice before saying the rest. He'd seen her do this with other things, the early conversations about the charges, the DNA explanation, the way she'd laid out what was coming before letting it land. She wasn't being slow. She was being careful. He didn't know why, but he knew she was measuring something. Nate, I need to tell you something that's going to change the way you understand a lot of things. And I need you to hear all of it before you respond because the pieces don't make sense individually. He nodded. Claire Brannick was not your biological mother. Tom Brannick was not your biological father. You were taken as an infant from a family in Whitfield County. Claire was a social worker assigned to that family. She removed you from the home and never filed the paperwork. She brought you home and raised you as her own. Nate didn't respond. Not because he was processing, because the thing she'd said hadn't connected yet. The words were in the right order. He understood what each one meant, but the sentence they made together was not a sentence that could be true, because it required a version of his life that couldn't be the version he'd actually lived. That's not right, he said. I know this is, that's not right. They were my parents. He could hear his own voice doing something he couldn't control. I have pictures. Claire was at every, she drove me to every game. She was at every performance. She made my lunches until I was old enough to make her stop because the other kids noticed. She held my hand when I had nightmares. When I was 9 and I had that dream about the stairs, every night for a month, she sat on the edge of my bed until I fell back asleep. That's my mother. That was my mother. She was your mother, Janet said. Everything that made her your mother, every one of those things, that was real. I'm not saying it wasn't. I'm telling you that biologically, don't say biologically like it matters more than everything else. He stopped himself. His hands were flat on the table and he was looking at them as if they could tell him something. She died and I held her hand back. I sat with her in that hospital for 3 days and I held her hand and she knew it was me. Don't tell me that's not real because of a file from before I was born. Janet let him say it. She didn't argue and she didn't retreat. She was still across the table and she waited with the patience of someone who knew that the argument was with the information, not with her. He thought about the photograph, Claire holding him as a baby. He'd taken it from Tom's house, and the cops had taken it from him when they processed him, and it was sitting in an evidence bag somewhere. Both of them squinting into the sun, her eyes half shut, holding him like he was already hers. She hadn't known him yet, and she held him like he was already hers. Whatever that was, it was real. The file from Whitfield County didn't reach backward and unmake it. Okay, he said finally. He wasn't agreeing, he was trying to make space. Janet told him the rest, not all of it. He would understand later that she was giving him what he could stand, in the order that made sense to receive it. At the time, he could only feel the shape of what she was telling him, the sense of more to come. His birth mother was a girl named Lily, 14 years old when she died bringing him into the world. He had a grandmother who'd cared for him for a short time. Claire had come to the home as a social worker and had not left him there. Tom had found out after Claire died. He'd been searching, databases, records, the law office in Whitfield, driving to the city without explanation, trying to find the biological family, trying to make amends for something that hadn't been his to confess. That's what he was doing, Nate said. That's why he, yes. His father had come to the city to try to fix something his wife had done.
He'd reached out to the biological family and invited someone to meet him in a hotel room, and that person had killed him. Tom had come to the city to do the right thing, and the right thing had walked him straight into the bathtub of room 1412. "Who?" Nate said. He stopped. He tried again. "Who was my biological father?" Janet's hands moved slightly on the table. He watched them. She was measuring something. He could see her doing it, the same calculation he'd seen her make before delivering anything that had weight, telling him things in order. "The investigation is still working through that," she said. He looked at her. The words were technically true, but they weren't the answer to the question, and they both knew it. "Is it something bad?" A pause, not long, the length of someone choosing their words. "We'll talk again when the investigation has moved further." He didn't push, he didn't have the energy for it, and there was something else, some part of him that had already mapped the shape of the gap, felt the outline of what wasn't being said, and was not sure it wanted to know yet. Not because he was afraid of the truth, because he'd just had his mother taken from him twice in the same hour, and there was a limit to how much could be removed at once. He was still her son. Whatever certificate existed was wrong, and the paperwork was wrong, and whatever was in the Whitfield County file was wrong, but he was still her son, and she had still sat on the edge of his bed when he was 9 years old and afraid of the dark. He held on to that. It was the only weight that wasn't pulling down.